You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening. My name's Elise Dellinger. I work with the Special Fund for Poverty Alleviation. And we are just thrilled to have Sasha Abramsky and Eyal Press with us this evening. We're both just stellar individuals. And I'll try to keep my introduction short because they'll talk more about the project in the conversation this evening. But just a bit of background on Sasha first. Sasha is a freelance journalist and a part-time lecturer in the University Writing Program at UC Davis. And he's worked on issues surrounding poverty for the past 15 years. And in 2009, he published Breadline USA, which discussed the hidden issues of hunger in the United States, and has published in The Nation, Salon, Daily Beast, and American Prospect, amongst other publications. And both our guests this evening have a connection to OSI. Sasha's is the fact that about 10 years ago, he was a Crime and Communities Media Fellow at OSI, so we're very happy to have him back with us this evening. Eyal is a New York-based journalist whose most recent book, which he's been traveling quite extensively, I've heard, promoting, is called Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times, which examines why and how ordinary individuals happen to do extraordinary things. And he's published articles in publications such as the New York Times Magazine, The Nation, The Atlantic, and was a James Aronson, or received the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism. So just to briefly discuss the Voices of Poverty website and multimedia project, we began working with Sasha in the summer of 2011, and the original idea was to have a book, which Sasha will talk more about, but we're very excited to see that coming out soon. And from the book grew the multimedia project, which also tied into a long article in The Nation that was published in April 2012 called The Other America. And we just really wanted to have a shift in the narrative about poverty in the United States and to show that there are sort of larger issues at stake here and to shift the onus from the individual and this emphasis on the individual choices that people make and saying that it's people's own fault, that they should pull themselves up by their bootstrap. So Sasha has traveled quite extensively around the country. And how many months would you say that you were traveling? In about 15 months. So it's been a very substantial project. And he's been interviewing people across the country to sort of have their stories and their lives captured in this project, which he will discuss further this evening. Without further ado, Eyal and Sasha.
Thank you for the introduction. Thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure to be at OSI and a particular honor to be here with Sasha, who I've known since the mid-90s. He's not only a great journalist, he's a good friend, and has always, I've always looked up to him as a voice of reason and a voice of integrity in journalism and beyond. That kind of voice is not easy to find, particularly in the media today. So I just want to begin, Sasha, by inviting you to talk about the Voices of Poverty project and what inspired you to do it. I believe, and the title of the article you just did for The Nation recalls this, I believe we're roughly 50 years after Michael Harrington published The Other America. Talk about the inspiration and about the project.
Yeah, and again, thank you all for coming out tonight, and Elise, thank you for that generous introduction. It's really Likewise, an honor to be on the panel with you, Ale. We have been friends for a long time. The question of poverty is something that's fascinated me for decades at this point, since I was in my early 20s and I'd moved from England to America. And it was New York in the early 90s, and the country was clearly fabulously wealthy. You know, we forget about it on a daily basis, but even compared to another first world country, when you come to America, you're stunned by the amount of opulence. But the other thing you're stunned by, if you're paying attention, is the amount of poverty. And from my very first few months in America, one of the things that struck me was that juxtaposition, that you could walk around Manhattan and in one block, it's Millionaire's Row. And then you're walking just a few blocks away and there are homeless people, there are mentally ill people, there are drug addicts. There's this sort of absolute visual poverty that is more sort of common in so-called third world countries. And for someone who came out of a country with a social welfare system, it stunned me. And I started writing, I started freelancing. And one of the things that I found was that this was an invisible narrative. And Michael Harrington had found the same thing in the early 60s. The thing that motivated Michael Harrington was that in the post-World War II period, nobody in America was talking about poverty. And I don't mean only a few thousand people. I mean, there was literally almost nobody. In the early 60s, a bibliography was done of all the academic literature on poverty that was extant at that point, not past literature, but existing current literature. And it filled two pages. No economists were writing about it. Very few sociologists were writing about it. The political system was not talking about it. And Harrington came to the conclusion that there was this sort of invisibility to poverty, that in the modern context, America had this sort of idea that it had solved or done poverty, that it was now an affluent nation. And Harrington was both a journalist and also an activist and also someone who spent a lot of time working with the poor. And he knew it just wasn't true. He knew that poverty was alive and well. And he ended up writing this book. It's called The Other America, and it's this fabulous expose of real conditions faced by real poor people all around America, in urban ghettos, in rural areas like the Mississippi Delta, in Indian reservations, and so on and so forth. And he very carefully documented the lives of this other America. So if you sort of fast forward a bit, I spent many, many years writing about different issues of poverty, crime and punishment, mental illness, drug addiction. And at a certain point, I kind of felt, well, I've said everything I want to say, maybe everything I can say about crime and punishment, but there's a larger story. Crime and punishment is a sub-story because we tend to deal with poverty, at least in part, by incarcerating it in this country. Not exclusively. It's not the only reason we have a prison system, but one of the functions of the modern-day prison system is as a poverty control mechanism. So it was a fairly easy segue from writing about crime and punishment to a much more general analysis of what poverty is in a modern context. And I got fascinated by it. And in the early 2000s, the country was booming. 2002, 3, 4, ton of money circulating. The housing market was doing well. The unemployment rate was fairly low. And there was this sort of cheerleader mentality. If you read the New York Times or you read the Wall Street Journal or you watched most of the major TV news programs, you could be excused for thinking that we were in another age of affluence. But I started going around the country and I'd talk to people and I'd go to these out-of-the-way communities and I'd find that there was this stunning level of poverty that was just below the surface. And it was a poverty that was hard to understand if you weren't looking for certain things, because it was a poverty that maybe came with a job attached, or it was a poverty that came with a fairly large house attached, or it was a poverty that came with a university education. But then there were all these things underneath the surface. There was a student loan that was unpayable. There was a home mortgage that was based on a predatory loan and was increasing every month or every few months, again, unpayable. There was that large house that was more a sort of Potemkin Village kind of thing than anything else. Or there was a job, maybe even two or three jobs, but that job was near minimum wage and it came with no benefits. And one of the reasons it came with no benefits was there'd been this very aggressive move against trade unions and various other organizations that had served to sort of counterbalance corporate power. And so the more I started exploring this, the more I got fascinated by it, that there is a story to be told. And that's what any good journalist wants, is a story to be told. And that's the genesis of this project. Now, obviously, that was in the good times. Post-2008, we sort of very rapidly entered the bad times. You get a whole bunch of data showing just how pervasive poverty is becoming. But I decided I wanted to tell this story, and in part I wanted to tell it by using the voices of people living these stories, living these lives, which is the genesis of this website, which we'll probably talk about in a minute, and I'd quite like to actually take on a little journey through that website.
Well, that was actually what I was going to ask. One striking difference between you and Harrington is time, and 50 years have passed, and you launched your project, I believe, a year ago?
Yeah.
With a website, and I wonder if you can just show us what's there.
Yeah, no, with pleasure. And, you know, Harrington himself was a child of the technological age. I mean, he had the ability to do recordings of his interviewees. He had the ability to take photographs and so on. But if you think about Harrington's machinery that was available to him and you compare it to that available today, it's much, much easier today. And I've got to say, I admire Harrington all the more for doing it in an era where the tape recorders were this size and the typewriters were this size, and there were no such things as cell phones and everything else, and he still managed to get around the country into all these communities and tell a good story. For me, it was the age of the laptop, it was the age of the digital tape recorder, the digital camera. I just needed a few USB ports, and I could start constructing a story. I didn't put the website together myself. I hired somebody at OSI's advice, at the Open Society's advice. But the basic template was I would go into a community, and I would do a lot of prep work. I would never do cold call interviews. You can't interview people about a subject as personal or as intimate about poverty without introductions. So I'd spend a lot of time finding out who I needed to talk to in a given community. I'd do the research. Where are the poverty hotspots? What are the problems? Is it a problem of labor? Is it a problem of healthcare access, education access, an overlap of several different things? And I'd start talking to groups, organizations, think tanks, food pantries, churches, and so on. And they would do introductions, and I'd go into a neighborhood, and I would do these long, long interviews with people. And then I'd re-interview them, and at a certain point, I'd take the tape recorder out, and I'd re-interview them again, and what you're getting is the sort of finished product here. But I'm going to migrate over to the podium, and I'm going to try and coordinate this so Elise can navigate you around the website while I'm talking. So let's see if this one works. Okay, so The Voices of Poverty is an audio archive, and the genesis for it is twofold. So one of them is Michael Harrington's The Other America. But the other one is some of the oral history projects that emerged out of the New Deal and emerged out of the Great Depression. And you have these tremendous archives going back 70, 75 years where people were telling the stories and showing the photographic imagery of life on the margins in a situation where the economic misery was overwhelming or risked being overwhelming. And one of the things that struck me as I went around the country was there are so many stories of poverty, and there are so many pathways into poverty, and there are so many reasons that people end up poor, there are so many reasons they stay poor, there are so many things that serve as obstacles to them getting out of poverty. And I wanted to find a way of showing that story in as interactive a way as possible. And the result is this website. Now, what you're on is the front page of the website. It's got a series of photo essays from around the country of poverty. So that's New Orleans post-Katrina. That was taken last summer. That's a destroyed inner-city high school in Philadelphia. That's a old couple in North California run a food bank, Colonias in New Mexico, and so on. Just a series of images of decay, images of despair. But where the bulk of the website is situated is in the tabs up ahead. And the two that are most important are the stories tab and the statistics and information one. The stuff on the right is sort of dead space at the moment. It's to be activated when my book comes out. It's called The American Way of Poverty, and it's coming out in about 6 months. And it's a sort of large overview of the stories of poverty and a set of solutions that could serve as a template for a modern-day war on poverty. So the last three tabs are more for that. But if you happen to have a sort of statistics bent, you can go onto the statistics and info site, and there's a whole bunch of live feeds. So you can get poverty data compiled by the federal government, you can get unemployment data, you can get data on number of people without health insurance in each state, and so on and so forth. What we're going to focus on today is the stories. And Elise, if you can click on the stories tab. The stories, at this point, have about 150 interviews from around the country. And Elise said I've been to about 20 states over 15 months. I'm guessing it was 20, it might have been 18, it might have been 21. It was a large number of states over many, many months. And it involved an awful lot of flying, driving, and every other mode of transport. And I'd go into different areas and try and tell stories specific to those areas. So you can go as far west as the Puna district on the Big Island of Hawaii and get stories about people living entirely off the grid, no running water, no electricity, living literally on the edge of the jungle in these shanties that they've self-constructed. That's one form of poverty. Then you can go to the Mississippi Delta and get this sort of very deeply ingrained historic poverty that sort of wells up out of hundreds of years of injustice. Then you can go to urban New York or Philadelphia. You get other stories. But then you can also go on my website to suburban Las Vegas. And you interview people who are living in these mansions. They have swimming pools in the backyard. And yet every single house on their block is in foreclosure. And every single person in that block is in bankruptcy. You can go to the same, get the same stories in Stockton in California. So what I wanted to do was give you as many entry points into the site as possible. So you can double-click, let's say, on California. So there are 22 stories audio archived from California from 9 different counties. So if you wanted to, you could access the stories that way. You can go onto the interactive map, you can just click around the country, and you're going to get over 100 stories. Most of them are ones that I've done by interview, but there's a user submission function, and it's sort of speckled all over the website that at different points you can just go in and you can upload your own stories. So there are probably 20 or 30 stories from around the country where people have just decided they wanted to tell their own stories. Now, if you weren't interested in the geography, but you were more interested in thematics, if you click back on the Stories tab and just double-click on the tab itself, you can go into Select Topic or Select Type. If you go into Select Type, you're given basically the option of a user submission story or my interviews. But if you select Topic, it's going to give you about, well, a large number of topics. Some of them are geographic. You can just go into the states that way. But some of them are thematic. Housing, education, healthcare, criminal justice, unemployment, wages, and so on. Now, what you'll find as you click on them is that you're going to meet the same characters in different locations. And one of the purposes of the website is to get people to think about the interconnections. So you're, in a minute, you're going to listen to one story. And there's, as I said, there are 100, but this is a particularly evocative interview, and it's fairly short, fairly self-contained. This guy called Joe, and I met him in Appalachian, Pennsylvania. He was in his late 50s, and he'd had major heart surgery, and he'd gone into bankruptcy as a result. And his life had just spiraled into absolute destitution. So you most obviously meet Joe under healthcare. But as you navigate the site, you're going to meet Joe in several different places as well. You're going to meet him under housing. Why you meet him under housing? Well, the thing is, he went bankrupt, and when he went bankrupt, he lost his house. When he lost his house, he had to move from a big suburban house to a very small subsidized living arrangement. So you meet Joe under housing. You meet him under hunger as well, because I happen to meet Joe in a food pantry, because even though he's on public assistance, the only way he can eat enough is by getting charity handouts from a local pantry. Now, it's very carefully constructed this way so that you're going to meet people in many different points. Joe's the norm rather than the exception here. Most of the people I interviewed, you're going to meet in 4 or 5 different parts of the website. And the intent of that is so that you can start as a viewer actively thinking about connections, different ways in which poverty is triggered, different ways in which it is perpetuated, and the impact, the consequence on people's lives. Because I think one of the things is we sort of tend to think about it as hermetically sealed sub-themes. You're poor because you had a healthcare emergency. You're poor because you lost your job. Usually it's a whole bunch of things overlapping. So bear with me now and listen for about 8 or 9 minutes. We're going to play Joe's story, and it is depressing, and I hope I sort of don't get you all sobbing by the end of it, but it gives you some sense of what poverty means to those who live it on a daily basis. Joe is 57 years old. He lives in a small town in central Pennsylvania. In 2008, when he owned a lumber company, Joe had a massive heart attack. Lacking health insurance, he was subsequently lumbered with a huge number of medical bills. The medical bills bankrupted him, took his home, put him into deep poverty. He now survives on $674 a month. Joe, talk to me about what happened to your life over the last few years.
Well, after I got too logging and stuff, I had four heart specialists from Reading tell me I'd never work again. I couldn't lift over 10 pounds. 8 weeks later, I had another heart attack. The first time I went in for open heart surgery, I had a quad triple bypass open heart surgery. The left side of my heart collapsed, so they took blood vessels out of my legs to put in my heart. They collapsed. They put six stents in the first time, and then they put four more stents in the second time I had a heart attack. And it's been pretty rough since then because I was always working. I was an always worker. I worked on a farm all my life. When I got done with this heart attack, it just blew my life right out of the water. I mean, I had to rely on food stamps, and I make $674 now a month, and my rent's $500. By the time I pay my electric bills, my cable, my phone, buy my toilet paper, it wouldn't be for my boys buying me toilet paper, I couldn't afford to take a shit. So I'm pretty well at a stop in my life, you know? I don't know, it's just like, this heart attack really screwed my whole life up. Lost my wife. I don't know. It's hard.
You got bills that were so large they just didn't make any sense to
you.
Oh,
yeah. I have bills. This quad triple bypass open heart surgery. I had bills that far. I couldn't even. I still wouldn't be able to get out of debt. I had to go to county assistance and get assistance to help me out. And they helped me out. And it wouldn't have been for them. I'd be so far in debt right now, I wouldn't even be able to live. You know what I mean?
Yeah, before the heart attack, you had a house.
I had a house, and I had to sell that just to pay my bills on the hospital. It was a rough life, you know what I mean? I mean, the only thing I can actually thank God for, my kid took me in after all this for like a year to help me out. And then when I did start getting ahead a little bit, I could afford my own apartment, but I'm scraping to do that nowadays.
What was your house like when you owned a house?
Well, it was a 5-bedroom house, 3 stories, full basement. It had 5 acres on it. It was a nice place.
What's your rental unit like now?
2-bedroom, living room, kitchen, bathroom, small. I ain't used to it, but for one person, I'll survive, you know. And yep.
And did you have retirement savings or other savings you also had to burn through?
No, I didn't have no retirement. I didn't think, I thought I was a young guy yet. I didn't even think about retirement. Well, 54 years old, people think about retirement. You know what I mean? Get a savings. Because as it is right now, I wish I would have when I was younger. Yeah.
Now, how do you live your life? I mean, if you're bringing in $674 a month, your rent's $500 a month, you got utilities and everything else. How do you eat? How do you socialize? How do you go about your daily existence?
Once again, county assistance gives me food stamps, $200 a month for food stamps. They take care of my medical bills. Like on the 8th now, I got to go up and they want to check the stents out I have in my heart and check my heart out. And I wouldn't even be able to afford to go to these doctors if they wouldn't even be able to help me. I wouldn't. I'd probably died by now. Yeah.
Now, before your heart attack, did you go out a lot? Did you have friends? Did you socialize?
Oh, yes. Yes, I did. I had my wife and I used to go bowling. I had friends. We used to go deep sea fishing. We used to go hunting. Now I can't even go hunting. I don't even know. I wouldn't even dare to go deep sea fishing. Yeah, I miss my social life. I do.
You get to go out at all? I know you got divorced, which is a separate part of your story.
Right.
But do you have a social life still, or can you?
No, I just sit home now. I can't even afford to go out. Like I say, I couldn't even afford toilet paper if it wouldn't be for my boys helping me out. They helped me out with toilet paper, soap, dish detergents, wash detergents. I couldn't even afford that. By the time I'm done with my bills, I'll be lucky if I have $10 a month. Now, if a person can live on 10 months and afford their stuff and go out and have a social life, I'd like to know how they do it.
So what do you do on a daily basis?
I get up, I...
So,
Just finishing the story. The thing about Joe's story that fascinated me was the isolation involved in it. Now, you know, some of it was self-imposed, and some of it, you know, if you're listening as a New Yorker and he's whining about only having two bedrooms for one person, some of it you take with a pinch of salt. But the sense of absolute social isolation and loneliness, this is a person who literally can't afford to go out for a cup of coffee with his friends, and that's one of the things that struck me most powerfully about poverty. And that's one of the things that you see on this site, is the psychology of loneliness in an affluent society. The psychology of poverty in an affluent society. What it does to one's sense of self, because I think one of the things is our sense of citizenship in a wealthy country is in part defined by what we can buy. And as you get poorer and as you're excluded from the basic rituals of social life, you buy less and less, and you're in a sense excluded from the community. You're in a sense excluded from full membership of the towns, the cities that you live in. And that's one of the things that this website really explores, is the psychology of poverty amidst affluence. And I think that's also what Harrington was getting at when he talked about the other America. It's this sense of marginalization and invisibility. Now, there are photos for a lot of the people I've talked to. In his case, he didn't want his full name used, didn't also want his image used. But if you surf the website, you'll see there's a lot of photography around the country, and the images of poverty in some sense are as powerful as the voices of poverty, because you can see in people's faces oftentimes that desperation, especially in the older people, especially in the older working people, because there's a sense of exhaustion as well. So that's essentially my 15-minute summary of what this website is. Last thing is, it's downloadable. It's a very useful, I hope useful, teaching tool, because it's downloadable and individual stories can be taken into the classroom and played and replayed and very easily distributed.
Thank you, Sasha. I want to ask, you mentioned that this guy's, Joe's, isolation was self-imposed, and it seems to me that one explanation, maybe the dominant explanation in popular discourse for poverty, is that in a sense it is self-imposed. In other words, that it is a product of cultural and behavioral pathologies of various kinds. Why is that view, is that view wrong? Is it entirely wrong? Is it partially legitimate? And if it's a mistaken view, why?
Yeah, there's a long and a rich history, not just in America, but in many countries, of blaming the poor for being poor, of creating a set of pathologies around poverty. Like any stereotype, sometimes there's a kernel of truth to it. And that's the problem with stereotypes. They feed off a kernel of truth and assume cartoonish proportions. And as they assume the cartoonish proportions, they lose all relevance. So we have in this country this idea of a slothful, lazy, promiscuous, oftentimes addicted, degenerate poor. You pick your derisive terminology and you'll find people, not just in the past but today, flinging those words against poor people. One of the most amazing comments I came across in my research for the book was a quote by Rush Limbaugh. And Limbaugh was opposing federal programs designed to provide food for impoverished children during school holidays as a bridging mechanism between school terms, because they weren't getting free lunches and breakfasts. And he went on this tirade about wanton little serfs. He wasn't talking about adults, he was talking about children, but he went on tirade about wanton little serfs and the dependency that was being bred in these children by this government program. And I think that there is this tendency to blame the poor for being poor. Now, if you medicalize something, or if you pathologize something, you look for medical solutions. And I don't mean you ask poor people to open their mouths and swallow pills, though we do that too. But you look for a set of solutions that essentially say, you've got a problem, it's your fault, and here's how I'm going to fix it. I'm going to give you tough love. You're on welfare, but you need to be working. So I'm going to put you on workfare. And if you don't work hard enough at this make work pretend job I'm going to give you, I'm going to take your welfare check away. In many states, they fingerprint you if you're going to apply for food stamps. People are sanctioned if they miss appointments with their various welfare agents or other counselors. Now, some of that might be valid, but we only do it for poor people. Imagine the outcry. And this is important because it's not only poor people who receive government assistance. Imagine the outcry if we said to grandma, yes, you can get your social security check from the government, but you've got to pee into a cup first to make sure you're clean of drugs. Or imagine if we'd said to the bankers when we bailed them out in 2008-09, yes, we're going to give your company not just a few thousand dollars, we're going to give your company hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, but you have to prove you're not on cocaine first. Or imagine if we'd said to someone applying for mortgage tax relief, which is one of the biggest government subsidy programs in the country. Yes, you can get your tax deduction at the end of the year unless you miss a counseling session with your banker, in which case we're going to take away your tax deduction for your own good. There'd be an absolute outcry. We couldn't do it and we shouldn't do it. But that is the kind of thing that we do as soon as we talk about aiding and assisting poor people. We make it punitive. Now, one of the wisest comments I encountered in my research was from Joanne Page, who I had hoped was going to be here tonight. She couldn't come in the end. She's the head of the Fortune Society in New York, and she's worked with prisoners and ex-prisoners and some of the poorest and most vulnerable parts of society for decades. And she said to me, look, the poor people, this is what I've learned from my work, she said, the poor people are no different from us except for the fact that they're poor. And I thought, you know, what a wonderful way of putting it. She's not saying they aren't different. She's just saying that the difference is the lack of money. Now, if you go back to Michael Harrington's period, two very different people said the exact same thing. On one side of the political spectrum, Martin Luther King said it. And on the other side, from the libertarian conservative side, Milton Friedman said it. And Milton Friedman actually in the late 60s came up with this idea called basic guaranteed minimum income based around a negative income tax. He said, be done with all of this punishment-based welfare systems. They don't work, they're humiliating, they don't do what's needed to be done, because what's needed to be done is give everybody a basic level of income. And there's a very easy way to do it in an affluent society, he said. You just write them a check. We have enough money that we could give everyone in this country a basic guaranteed income, not to make them wealthy, but to avoid destitution. That we don't as a policy choice. It was probably Friedman's greatest insight. And I think this is all a long answer to your question, but I think that as soon as you stop stereotyping poor people, as soon as you realize, A, the complexity of the story, the fact that we're talking about poverties rather than poverty, the fact that we're talking about real people rather than a single abstract poor person, as soon as you realize the complexities, then you can't reduce it to pathology anymore. And as soon as you stop the stereotypes, the policy responses become more nuanced and the economic responses become more nuanced. And that can only be a good thing for a discussion of poverty.
Just a quick follow-up, since you brought up grandma stereotypes. How much do you think the difference in the sort of, you know, what popular outcry would follow from a similar kind of draconian policy administered to, say, elderly people, is that when you say grandma, people assume the face of the person is white. And when you say poverty, people assume the face of the person is black or brown.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, that anyone who studied poverty, and I assume most people in this room have some connection with poverty, anyone who studied poverty knows it's multicolored. It's as American as America is. It's everyone. You look at a picture of poverty in America, and it's a gap image, or it's a multicultural image. It's young, it's old, it's black, it's brown, it's white. It's everything. You can't reduce poverty to one color. You can't reduce it to one demographic. But in the stereotype, you can. And that's why you had in the presidential campaign, for example, you had these extraordinary comments by people like Rick Santorum in the primaries, where they very explicitly said, they didn't even sugarcoat it, they very explicitly said that they weren't there to give black people money. Santorum said that in public at an event in the primary season. he made this comment that, you know, he wasn't in it for the federal government to give black people money. It was this incredible statement that basically was Obama's the food stamp president. It was part of that rhetoric. Gingrich said very similar things in the primary season. You could never in a million years say that about elderly people. And I think your point is well taken, that we have these assumptions. We obviously intellectually know that not all elderly people are Caucasian, but there are these stereotypes. There are these stereotypes that certain groups are deserving, and they're more deserving because we think of them as more white. And certain groups are less deserving, and at least in part they're less deserving because we think of them as more black and brown. I say think of because it's not the reality. And again, when you look at the government data, and I've got a ton of data in my book, there's a ton of data on this website, I don't intend to bombard you with statistics right now. You'd all walk out of here and there'd be way too much food left over. But whenever you look at the statistics, you do see that there are a stunningly high number of white people who are poor, and black people, and Latino. Now, there are a disproportionately high number of black and Latino people in poverty, and there are many reasons for that. One of them, in more recent years, is that predatory lenders in the 90s and 2000s very aggressively went after middle-class African-American and Latino communities and wiped out their equity, wiped out 30 years of wealth accumulation in about 3 or 4 years of bad lending. That's one reason you've seen these stunning rises in African-American and Latino poverty in the last few years. You've seen a far lower rise of white poverty because predatory lenders didn't tend to go into white communities. But that said, if you look at the data, you'll see year in, year out, from the year 2000 onwards, poverty across all demographics increased. And I say from 2000 onwards because that's important. That was during the boom years. For 8 years before the 2008 crash, poverty increased year in and year out. Partly it was to do with predatory lending, but partly it was to do with the fact that we have an inequality problem in this country. And a large part of my research, even though this is a book on poverty, a large part of my research is about the politics of inequality. How do we get into a situation where 0.1% of the population, 30,000 people, maybe that's 0.01%, control 3% of the country's income? And it's 0.01% of the population controls 3% of the country's income. 30,000 people control several trillion dollars of assets. Well, if 30,000 people control several trillion dollars of assets, it's not quite a zero-sum game, but it's not far off. That means an awful lot of people have virtually no assets. We're a $17 trillion economy. If 30,000 people control a significant chunk of that economy, not surprisingly, you see huge upswells in poverty. And you see huge upswells in economic insecurity. It's what the economist Jacob Hacker calls the great risk shift. If you are an ordinary working American, especially one without a university education, year in, year out, your life is getting more insecure. If you have a university education, you work in an industry like finance or something else, you're doing very well. But for the vast majority of people, life is getting more rather than less insecure. And that's tied in with our politics. It's tied in with economic developments that led to inequality. But the cumulative impact is an expansion of poverty.
Sasha, we just had a presidential election. We had three nationally televised debates. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think the word poverty was mentioned maybe three times. And each time, I think, not by Obama, but by Romney. When he indicted Obama's economic performance, he sort of had a laundry list: jobs missing, unemployment rate, lack of jobs, and poverty. But there was no debate, there was no discussion whatsoever about poverty as a social issue that should be tackled, that should be addressed. Why is poverty so missing from political discourse in this country? And let's face it, from the discourse of Democrats, no less than Republicans.
No, that's a great question. And it's one that anybody who cares about poverty has to wrestle with. And it ties in with what I was saying in the last answer about the politics around this. If you live in a country suffering famine and crop failure, the poverty you experience is more akin to an act of nature. If you live in a country like America, greatest food production engine in history, greatest wealth producer in history, and you're in poverty. You're in poverty at least in part because of policy choices. It's very rare to be in poverty in America because of an act of nature. I think what's happened is increasingly the political process has been hijacked, and I'm using that word deliberately. It's been taken over illegitimately, coercively, by moneyed interests. Now, money's always played a role in politics. There's no point in sort of putting on rose-tinted spectacles and looking for a glory day when money played no role in American politics. It's not going to happen. But there are greater and lesser moments for the role of money, and we're in one of those moments and have been for at least 10, 20 years now where money is on a stampede. You can buy ever greater access to the political system. And money does buy access, and it buys it very well. And one of the things that happens is political priorities shift. We have poverty in America because of a series of policy choices. We have done a lousy job at maintaining a progressive taxation system. We've done a terrible job at making good education universally available. We don't have family leave on anywhere near the level that most other affluent countries have it. We have a healthcare system that, until very recently, made it almost a sort of point of principle to exclude tens of millions of people from health insurance. We have a welfare system that is at best dysfunctional and at worst deeply, deeply coercive and massively incomplete. We have tens of millions of people who can't access welfare because they're just above the poverty line, or they have $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 of assets and therefore they're deemed too affluent. We have a series of policy choices that keep poverty as invisible as possible. Now, you said that the Democrats don't mention it, neither do the Republicans. It's true. I tend to think, and this might be sort of optimism on my part, I tend to think Democrats care marginally more about it than do Republicans. So why aren't they talking about it? I had a somewhat depressing interview with a very keyed in lobbyist, progressive guy in Washington about a year ago. And he said to me, look, I went to the Obama people at the beginning of the administration, and they promised me that they would adhere to the half in 10 goal, cutting poverty in half in 10 years. And they cared about it. They really did. But then it became this third rail. And he basically said, and I've got to be, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but he essentially said, look, the Obama people are scared that if they focus too exclusively on the rhetoric around poverty, you know, they do some stuff behind the scenes. They've made some sort of fairly good technocratic fixes. But if they talk about poverty, they're going to be seen to be, and this was his quote, they're going to be seen to be pursuing a black agenda. And I think this comes back to this stereotype that we talked about a few minutes ago, which is that an awful lot of people in America have this stereotype that poverty is a black issue. It's nonsense. It's intellectual rubbish. But it's a powerful enough stereotype that it serves as some kind of third rail. And so instead we use euphemisms. And the euphemism of choice, now it's been the euphemism of choice at least since the Clinton era, but the euphemism of choice these days is the struggling middle class. The problem is terms have meaning, language has meaning. If you stretch the definition of the middle class to include everybody from the person earning $250,000, which is the cutoff for the discussion about whether or not to raise taxes, all the way down to someone earning $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 on a part-time job, and you say they're all part of the struggling middle class, it becomes very, very difficult programmatically to come up with any meaningful solutions. If you have a better language and you talk about the working class, or you talk about the poor, or you talk about the other America, I don't really care what the phrase is, but if you have an alternative that allows you to say, yes, there is a middle class with its own set of needs, there's a struggling middle class or an aspirational middle class with its own set of needs, and then there's people who just don't fit by any definition the struggling middle class and have their own needs and their own political priorities, well, then you open up the conversation a little bit more. My sense is that there's room for that conversation, but it's going to have to come from the ground up. It isn't going to come from lobbyists in D.C. There's one registered lobbyist that works exclusively on poverty in D.C. out of 5,000 lobbyists. It isn't going to come from D.C. It isn't going to come from the political class, because the political class knows where its bread is buttered. But I do tend to think there is room for that conversation at the moment because of audiences like this, because of the fact that all around the country, There are groups thinking about it. There are individuals thinking about it. There are movements, whether it's Occupy, whether it's the National People's Action. There are a whole group of movements out there doing very creative thinking around poverty and gradually injecting some of that language back into the political discourse. But I do think it's one of the great shames of the Obama first administration is the lack of rhetorical focus on poverty. In fact, I read somewhere that Obama's last State of the Union was the first presidential State of the Union since 1948. I might have the dates wrong, but something like that, where poverty was not mentioned once in the State of the Union. So there's clearly some work to be done to get the political classes to go where they need to go on this one.
A little bit following up on that, I think there's, along with the assumption that poverty is basically a product of pathology, that behavioral and cultural pathology, hand in hand with that and fitting very well with that belief is another one, which is that government programs to reduce poverty are either ineffective or perverse. They either do nothing and they're a waste of taxpayer money, or they do something, but what they do is make poverty more extreme and feed the bad behavior that causes it. That at least seems to me the sort of one major reason why there isn't a robust policy discussion. We don't have time for that tonight, but can you just generally comment on, A, whether you think government programs actually can reduce poverty in a meaningful way, and if so, which ones?
Well, can they? The answer is easy. Yes, they can. The evidence is there from past practice in America. It's there in other countries. If you look at what happened in the Great Depression, government intervention took unemployment down from 25% when Roosevelt came into power to 9% a few years later. Government intervention created Social Security. Public works programs put millions of people back to work. There's no doubt about it that good, well-thought-through government programs work. I don't think anybody, maybe a couple nutcases on the far right, but most people would not challenge the existence of Social Security. The Republicans might have talked about privatizing or voucherizing parts of Medicare, but almost none of their candidates talked about literally eliminating Medicare. In her more off-the-wall moments, Michelle Bachmann went perilously close to that. But almost no serious candidate talks about eliminating Medicare because it works. It takes people out of poverty. The elderly poverty rate in the late 50s was nearly 30%. It's about 10% today. There are very clear indicators that it works. But if you tell people often enough that governments only sell you lemons, then people eventually believe that governments only sell you lemons. And this, I write about this a lot in my book, the methodology that the Grover Norquist crowd has sort of adopted over the years. Grover Norquist's mission is to massively reduce taxes, not for you and me necessarily, but for very, very wealthy people and corporations. But to get, in a democracy, people to vote for that, you've got to convince an awful lot of people that government never delivers bang for the buck and therefore why fund it. Norquist's whole thing is he wants to starve the beast. That's his quote, the beast being government. Starve it till it's small enough that you can then strangle it in the bathtub. He has this sort of series of piquant phrases about what he wants to do with government. If you tell people that government's lousy, if you tell people it's stealing your money, if you tell people that every dollar you give in taxes is a dollar wasted, and if you then produce a series of mediocre government services and say, see, I told you so, well, of course people are going to get angry. So if you underfund education to the point where the schools are dysfunctional, and you then say, hey, we better privatize the school system, well, people suddenly start tolerating privatization initiatives. If you say to people, look, welfare is a sham, it doesn't work, it keeps people poor, and then you make welfare so abysmally humiliating and punitive, yes, people are going to look at it and they're going to say, what a horrible program, let's do away with it. So I think the answer is, it can work, but we've been told for a generation it can't. In order for it to work again, we have to have a new political language, a new political dialogue. It's a sort of chicken and egg thing. I think the politics comes first. I recognize there's room for argument that if you produce a good program, proof's in the pudding and people are all going to suddenly turn around and like government. But I think it's a political project that needs to be done first. We have to re-educate people about the role of government in life. Doesn't mean we have to suddenly go out and say all government is good all of the time. It isn't. It's always good to have a healthy degree of cynicism. But we do have to have a national conversation about why we have government. We've been told for years that it's an evil institution, barely necessary. It's a partially necessary evil institution. I think we have to have a conversation about why it can be a beneficial institution. I think Hurricane Sandy provided, amidst all the heartbreak, a tremendous opportunity for that. You suddenly saw Chris Christie and various others, eyes wide open, suddenly aware of the fact that maybe we need FEMA. Maybe we need government with power to come in and fix things when they go massively wrong. You had room for that in 2008-09 when people suddenly thought maybe government regulation of the banking system is not an entirely bad thing. That was sort of partly frittered away. But I think there's room for it again. You had a tremendous number of people come out in 2012 in the elections against big money. You had hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars being thrown into the political process. It was Karl Rove's strategy of basically saturating the political process, post-Citizens United, with money and buying the system. He got exactly zero return for it. He spent hundreds of millions of dollars. Almost none of his candidates won. I think there's an opportunity there. So my sense is that we have to have that political conversation. We have to re-inject the possibility that government can do good. And then we have to very aggressively ensure that it does. Because I think the worst thing you could do is say government does good and then continue to deliver lemons. And that is sort of where my book ends up, picking up from where the Voices of Poverty left off. And there's a pretty detailed discussion in there of set of policy solutions that I think would make a pretty significant difference to various different aspects of this discussion.
Should we open it up to questions?
Be happy to.
Hello. I'm old enough to remember the war on poverty under Johnson's administration. And I could tell you from experience, I was a social worker at the time. And the money didn't go to the poor. It went to the vendors who served the poor. So when you talk about a possibility of government helping the poor, I remember this particular issue during the, when was it, the 60s and 70s. And I just feel hopeless about it.
No, I appreciate that. And I'm going to partially agree with you and partially disagree. There's no doubt about it, the war on poverty did create what was called a poverty industry. That there were a lot of vendors who used it, abused it, applied for grants and so on. But to say that poverty was not impacted at all by the war on poverty, I think is too pessimistic. When you look at the institutions that were created, when you look at the fact that Medicaid took off then, when you look at the fact that food stamps took off and was expanded then, when you look at some of the investments in education, when you look at the Pell Grant, there's a whole bunch of things, some still in existence today, that changed an awful lot of Americans' lives. When you look at the amount of money that was invested in nutritional programs that took elderly people in particular out of poverty, I think that the war on poverty has tremendous successes amidst the failures. And when you actually look at the numbers of people, and the government has a fairly accurate measure of poverty, and it's a technical measure. I can talk about it if you want, but there's been this measure of what poverty is that's existed for about 55, 60 years at this point. And by that government measure, poverty rates were massively reduced in a 10-year period from the mid-60s to the mid-70s. And I say 10 years because it wasn't just under Johnson. Johnson is credited with the war on poverty. It actually predates Johnson by a little bit, not terminologically. He creates the term, but Kennedy creates some of the infrastructure for the war on poverty. But it also postdates Johnson. And in actual fact, if you look at Nixon's presidency, there's a lot of vile language about the poor. He talks about a silent majority, and he talks about people being angry at welfare users and so on and so forth. But behind the rhetoric, Nixon was actually almost as much of a great society president as Johnson. Nixon did tremendous things. Nixon actually proposed, like Milton Friedman, Nixon proposed a basic income, never got it through. Nixon proposed a universal health care plan very similar to the one that Obama has just managed to pass. In fact, almost identical structurally to what Obama passed. In many ways, Nixon and Johnson are a partnership in the war on poverty. And that lasts into the mid-70s. It actually starts ending with Carter, which is sort of an uncomfortable reality, but it's Carter who starts sort of rolling back a lot of the welfare changes. But I think it's far too pessimistic to say it did nothing on poverty. So that's where I disagree a little bit.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I thought there was no way to email a particular story on the website. And I thought if there's not, that would be helpful because I would like to do that, be able to do that. But I have a question, too.
You actually can. They're downloadable. You can, I believe, email the URL, the specific stories, and you can certainly Facebook it and tweet it. So individual stories can be tweeted or whatever it's called.
Yeah, for those who avoid all social network sites, that's difficult. Even 50 years before Harrington, you had How the Other Half Lives with Jacob Riis. So I was wondering if there's a sin that need not ever be spoken, and that's capitalism as an underlying problem. And I think actually it's important that it be spoken because it subsumes all of the individual aspects of money and politics and the policies, scapegoating or using racism to scapegoat the poor.
I think it's an important part of the conversation. My sense from my reading of history, from my reading of sociology and so on, my sense is that most systems, in fact probably all systems, produce poverty, that different systems produce different variants on it. It manifests itself in different ways. There are more or less prevalent forms of poverty. I would say that, yes, some aspects of capitalism produce an awful lot of poverty and also produce an awful lot of wealth. The question becomes one of management. One of the writers that I think is incredibly interesting on this is a guy called Karl Polanyi. And he was a refugee from Nazi-occupied Europe, and he moved to London in the 40s. And at the end of World War II, while the war was still going on, he wrote a book basically urging a regulated market system. And it was sort of in counterpoint to Hayek and some of the more sort of libertarian economists of the period. And his point was that markets are very dynamic. Karl Marx, I guess, made a similar point, but he wasn't a Marxist. He was a social democrat. He made this point, the markets are very dynamic, but if left to their own devices, they're incredibly destructive. That a market society which is run for the benefit of markets is a society where morality gets cast to one side because it becomes all about whether or not you can make a profit, definitionally. And Polanyi didn't propose an overthrow of capitalism. He wasn't someone who said, let's take to the barricades about this. What he said was, we can use the political process to regulate it and manage it. Now, it's not a sort of particularly romantic, it's not nearly as romantic a vision as the sort of taking to the barricades vision, but it's a very pragmatic vision. And in a sense, it's the sort of intellectual predecessor to the social democracies of the Scandinavian countries. It was also a very influential book in the 30 years after World War II in America. And that's important because it was always a capitalist system. There was no period between 1945 and 1975 when America veered off course and became a non-capitalist society. It was always capitalist. But there was a period when it was more regulated and managed. And one of the side effects of that was inequality went down. Year in, year out, inequality went down. One of the secondary side effects was poverty went down as well. Now, one of the interesting things I found in my research was across the board, there was an agreement that inequality was going to decrease rather than increase in the post-war period. And I found this fascinating report published by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which, you know, is one of the great bogeymen of the modern political system. But they put together a committee in the mid-60s with 100 titans of industry, all of the top CEOs, and their report concluded that we didn't have to worry about inequality because as advanced capitalist societies evolved, they had their internal dynamics where inequality would decrease, where the gap between the wealthiest and the poorest would decrease, and that was a good thing. This was the 100 titans of industry in the mid-60s. Now, they were wrong. It turned out inequality started rampaging again. But that was the political template of the time, that capitalism was okay, but it needed to be managed and regulated, and institutions and systems needed to be put in place to ensure that inequality was moderated and by default poverty. So I do think you're right, it's a part of the conversation, But since I don't think we're about to, you know, maybe I'm wrong, things move quickly, but I don't think the world is about to literally man the barricades and overthrow capitalism. In the meantime, there's another question. The question is, what kind of capitalism? Do we want a more or a less humane version of capitalism? At the moment, we've got the least humane kind we can possibly get. We're doing almost nothing to mediate inequality. So how do we get to another situation? I think that's where the conversation's heading in the next few years. What can we do within the system to make it function in a, you know, at least marginally more humane way? Yes.
I'm certainly not a liberal, and that's why usually when I come to open society, I'm most skeptical. But I listen with all my sympathy, compassion, and I understand that what you're talking about, that's not a matter of intellectual exercise for you, but that's certainly your moral conviction. So my brain and heart with you. Now I want you to convince me one more about my skepticism. We had time when Obama was elected, former community organizer, where Congress was majority Democratic, when press and people on the street, electorate, supported him, and you see where it come from. They were unable, impotent to change anything. Even so-called Obama medical reform, that's not a reason to prize, to be happy about. Just opposite, in such form, it would just compromise the very idea, impossibility of medical care for whole nation. And you remember Stiglitz, Joseph Stiglitz. Everyone. Every politician, every editor of big newspaper, I'm not even talking about TV stations, they belong to 1%. What you can do with this utopian, wishful idea that education can help? You have professors in university. They preach about what they can do against this power of financial oligarchy who can control and destroy everything. And if they tolerate you until now, only because you are not harmful for them. Just because you and people who are sympathetic with you, like even Wall Street, have a look what happened with them. It become a joke. So it seems to me that only one way, you know Louis Mumford, from my point of view, greatest American thinker. Even in 60, he understood that only major catastrophe, major collapse of the system can bring any changes. Otherwise, we create illusion that we can do something in circumstances like now, this golden rule of oligarchy, tomorrow they will be stronger than today and take more than today. We have to wait only for Messiah, if you believe it. And Obama proved he is not a Messiah.
I mean, you're raising a lot of really interesting points. Okay. So let me try and tackle some. And if I forget some, forgive me. But I think you're absolutely right that when Obama came in 08, and actually what you said about the sort of messianic qualities that are needed, I think a lot of people in 08 felt that that campaign had those qualities. And I always thought it was a little bit overinflated. There was this sort of hysteria around it that Obama's going to get elected, he's going to wave a magic wand, and he's superhuman, and all of the powers are going to suddenly, all of the problems are going to be suddenly made right. It was a very naive sort of feeling. And I think it was born of desperation that the country was collapsing. Now, you talk about sort of catastrophe breeding opportunity. There was this sense that the country was on the edge of a precipice. And Obama represented something different. He clearly did. There's absolutely no doubt about it that Obama was cut from a different cloth. He was a community organizer. His experiences, his life experiences were different from almost every predecessor president. But he wasn't a superhero. And to think he could do everything simultaneously was always disingenuous. And I think that part of the disillusionment that was seen in 2009 and 2010 came about from the realization that the political process, even after Obama was elected, was going to remain messy. That it was going to remain hostage to extremists sometimes, that it was going to have this series of horrible negotiating processes behind it, that oftentimes good ideas would get stuck in a dysfunctional congressional system and so on. And I think that realization was in some ways quite shattering. And so you talked about healthcare reform. You know, here was this, you know, huge opportunity to do one of the biggest social transformations since the New Deal or Great Society, and it got bogged down in one of the ugliest political processes in a generation. Now, I might differ from you. My sense was, when listening to you, that you had no sympathy for the Obama healthcare reform. I actually think it does a lot of good. It wouldn't have been my first choice for how I would have structured universal healthcare, but I think it does far more good than harm. But that said, it certainly was a million miles away from the utopian premise of 2008. You mentioned education reform, and I think sort of the same thing, that we look for panaceas. Now, with education reform, for about 10, 15 years, there's been this rhetoric that if only we can get all schools up to speed, it will be a magic bullet, a silver bullet that will end poverty. Well, it's nonsense. I mean, if you read people like Diane Ravitch, for example, or I think it's Andrew Rothstein, there are a bunch of very important progressive critiques of the notion that schools can be a cure-all. And the reason for that is fairly straightforward, that schools are a part of an environment. You can make schools as state-of-the-art as you like, but if kids are going to schools hungry, and if kids are going to schools in communities where their parents don't have jobs, and if kids are going to school in areas where gangs are omnipresent, you're going to have a problem in the classroom. There's no way you can hermetically seal off the classroom experience from the broader communal experience. Now, that doesn't mean education reform isn't worthy. All it means is it's got to be done in tandem with a set of other changes. It means we have to think more outside the box when we're thinking about what education reform is. One thing I was saying about my website is it was designed to look at connections. Well, one of the connections in education is healthcare. One of the more interesting movements in recent years in schooling has been what are called community learning centers. And one of the things these centers do is they bring healthcare into schools in low-income areas. Why did they do that? Well, one of the things that reformers realized was a whole bunch of kids were going to school without reading glasses. They couldn't read. They couldn't see the boards. They couldn't see the computers. So they set up vision clinics in a lot of these schools, and suddenly educational attainment starts going up. If you bring the parents into those settings and you allow the parents to get free medical treatment as well, you do the same thing. Instead of that kid going home to an environment where the parents are routinely ill, kids go home to an environment where the parents are healthy, have energy, and can actually spend a bit of time with the children. Again, none of that's a panacea, but it does mean that if you're going to look for reform, you have to look at it holistically. Now, coming back again to your political argument, the idea that you need a catastrophe in order to make things better, possibly. You know, again, we came perilously close to a catastrophe in 08. My sense is that you don't need a catastrophe to make things better, but you do need a fear of a catastrophe. And 08 provided that fear, and the impetus was there for change. And some of that change was passed, and some of it was frittered away. Now, one of the things that interests me about the last election is that, in a sense, Obama was given a very rare opportunity to rewrite his own script. He came in with these soaring ambitions in 08, and it got bogged down in a very messy, very partisan political process. And instead of him getting booted out of office, he got reelected. And I think that provides a tremendous opportunity if he is serious. I don't know if he is serious or not, but if he is serious about change, if he's serious about addressing things like poverty, he's been given a golden opportunity to do it in his second term. And I think we could see some very creative politics and very creative dialogue in the next couple of years.
Hi. So I just wanted to talk about or ask about sort of that you said that Obama couldn't talk about poverty because sort of the racializing of it. And I don't believe in all these categories of discrimination, but you know, I used to work for Michael Harrington, so I know it's structural and all that. But part of the poverty story is about racism, and there are other forms of discrimination that are part of the poverty story also, and that would be also misogyny. And I now work for a disability rights organization, so discrimination against people with disabilities. And I mean, I remember in 1996 when they did welfare reform and everybody was like, this is racist, you know, he's so racist. And I'm like, come on, this is misogynist. But nobody articulated that. And now that I work on disability rights, I see that we don't articulate that that people are discriminated against on the basis of disability. Even your story, this guy has a disability. He probably doesn't want to say that, you know. But I'm just thinking it would be really, I now I work on healthcare. I don't work, you know, there's no funding for anti-poverty attorneys. So, there's funding for healthcare. And to try to bring these different health disparities communities together where, you know, they talk about race and women and disability status. And there are some common features or some uncommon features. But I think it would be good to, like you said, you try to interweave the stories to bring up these other aspects of discrimination and highlight discrimination as a reason for poverty, and that it might actually help us with the discourse if it's not just race, you know.
No, I appreciate that, and that was an omission in my discussion. If you go through the website and you go through, well, the book's not out yet, but when it's out, you read it, you'll see that I do talk a lot about, especially single motherhood, which is the single biggest trigger for poverty in the entire country. Disability as well triggers poverty. And again, there are some racial overlaps. There's in New York, for example, there's a roughly equal percentage of the white African-American and Latino population in New York who are disabled. But among the disabled, if you are African-American, you are more likely to be poor. So there, it gets really, really complicated as you overlap these different categories. But you're entirely right. If you reduce it all to race, you lose the richness and complexity of the story. And I'll come back to what I said earlier. You know, the story of poverty in modern-day America is as complicated as the story of America itself. It's just absolutely impossible to reduce it to one group, one region, one age status, or anything else. It's rural, it's urban, it's old, it's young. There are just so many different ways you can subdivide it, and that's because the pathways into and out of poverty are so increasingly complicated. We talk about us being an opportunity society. One of the buzzwords a few years ago was that, you know, there are pathways to opportunity, or we need to build pathways to opportunity. All of that is true. But in the flip side, you have pathways to poverty. And the challenge then becomes, how do you block those pathways? How do you provide a set of policy responses? And it shouldn't become a technocratic discussion, because it's really a moral discussion. How and why should we block these pathways so that fewer people go into and remain in poverty? And to have that conversation, you're absolutely right. You've got to look at it in its full complexity. And so, yes, it shouldn't just be reduced to race. And if I came across that way, I apologize.
We have about 5 minutes, so questions, as opposed to statements. Oh, we have more than 5 minutes. I'm sorry. I misinterpreted a hand signal. Okay, forget that. But do keep your questions to questions rather than speeches. Thanks.
Okay, so I'll try to make this a question quickly. But my question is about how we have a discussion in the disparate sections of our society. So I've worked in social service my entire career, and I got very frustrated feeling like we weren't speaking the same language as our funders, especially our corporate funders. And so I decided, out of a theory, that I should go and get my MBA. So during my week, I am managing homeless shelters, and on my weekend, I'm at NYU Stern. And I found out that we are even further apart than I ever thought. And I'm really wondering, how do we bring this discussion to the fuller community? Is that something you've had success with, and how do we do it? Because I'm really frustrated about that.
No, I think it's, you know, I mean, that in a sense is the entire sort of purpose of this project, because I think that for an awfully long time, poor people have been talked about, not just in America, but in most countries. Poor people tend to be less influential. They tend to have less access to public spaces, tend to have less access to the media and so on. There are many reasons, but poor people tend to be more talked about than talked with. And so one of the intents of my project was to bring alive their stories. So, you know, I can talk about it. I do it in settings like this. But I think it's at least as valuable having the voices of people who've been living this life explain it. And so you're talking about homeless shelters. There's at least 5 or 10 people dotted around various parts of this website who I interviewed in homeless shelters, in motels. There's a guy I interviewed in Phoenix, an Air Force veteran, and he and his family, his wife and 3 kids, were living in a 1-bedroom motel room. I interviewed a number of women escaping domestic violence situations in shelters. And it's their stories. Now, you know, I'm not sure how one of the earlier questioners asked about whether you can email these stories around. I'm not sure the exact logistics on this site, but it's fairly portable. If you can't email them, you can certainly upload them, download them, tweet them, Facebook them. And then, you know, my site's not the only one. NPR has archived a whole bunch of stories of people's lives in poverty, their various local initiatives. And oral history is a powerful tool, and you can bring those voices into public settings. The sort of broader question about, you know, how do you amalgamate the language of the funders and the language of people living the life of poverty? Your way of, you know, of living in both those worlds is probably not a bad one. Beyond that, you should probably talk to Elise rather than me, because I'm actually not in the funding world. But I do think it's important to have as many voices as possible at the table in these conversations.
Hi, I have a number of questions, but I'll boil it down to just one. I design and produce websites professionally. So looking at your website, my question is, what are you trying to accomplish here? I mean, you're here preaching to the choir.
Yep.
You know, we're all on your side. And I'm guessing that anybody who comes across and spends any time on the website is already... Anyway, my question is, what are you trying to accomplish and what could be accomplished?
Well, if you're right, then the website has failed. And you could be right. I mean, we do have Google Analytics on there. My web designer looks at it. I don't. So, you know, I have to bow to him on the technical side. It's possible it is only reaching the choir. My intent in setting it up was to make it extremely versatile, extremely user-friendly, and as a teaching tool. I mean, that is the primary intent, is that you can take these stories. If you're a sociology professor teaching a course on poverty and you've got 200 students, you can take these stories and you can play them. You can play them to large audiences. If you're in a policy setting, I mean, one of the things I want to do and hope very much to do when the book comes out, I want to take this to DC. The Progressive Caucus runs hearings on poverty. I want to take these voices into DC and actually have people like Joe and the 100 others on this website actually doing a virtual testimony in Congress. If people are talking about cutting food stamps, that was one of the big things being discussed last year in the debt ceiling crisis, is probably still on the table. I want people who are going to lose food stamps and who are on that website to have a voice in DC. Now, that's the use of it. How to do it, I'll take any and every suggestion. If you're a web designer and have ways of getting broader access, broader audiences, by all means, please let me know and I'll let my web designer know. But the intent is to keep this thing alive. And other thing is the user submission function. And that function makes it easy for people anywhere in the world, but I mean it's primarily a US thing, to upload their own stories. Now, at the moment, it's not too many. But this site is not going anywhere. It's going to be there for years. And at some point, I want it to just essentially be an audio archive telling the story of post-2008 America, what it was like on the margins in a period as bad in some ways for many people as the Great Depression. So that's what I hope it will end up doing.
I have 2 questions, pretty quick, I think, or simple to ask in any event. Question number one is that you mentioned the Milton Friedman guaranteed income idea, which I've always, all my life, been utterly fascinated by. And have you thought about it much from a policy perspective, and just give us an understanding of what's good or bad about it, you know, if you, in terms of the research you've done, what you've come across, is it actually feasible? That's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, in politics and with reform, sometimes there are wedge issues that in a sense become trains that a lot of change rides on. So dealing with America's elderly was a big train that from FDR forward, a lot of other reforms got passed through and held up to. And in some ways it continues to be the case, because talking about Social Security and Medicare at least, is a cushion for a lot of other things. Do you think, I mean, I think, my feeling is that healthcare has the potential to be that train of transformation and is not just Obama's, but our society's opportunity for fundamental change. And given the work you've been doing, I was wondering about your opinions on that, not just out of this, but some of your other books too.
Yeah, no, John, both of those are important. The basic income is feasible. A variant of it is in use today. The earned income tax credit is a sort of bastardized offspring of the basic income tax idea, of the basic guaranteed income idea. It's a less sophisticated version of it. It's a more politically sellable version, but the principle is somewhat similar. In my book, I talk about more and less ambitious, more and less realistic proposals for the basic guaranteed income. Some of them are utopian. There is a movement in America which has argued that every man, woman, and child should be granted a basic income, and the way you do it is you write every man, woman, and child a check, and then it gets taxed very heavily at the back end. It's a $2 trillion a year proposal. Most of that money would come back at the end of the tax year, but there's no way you could sell it. And so it's one of those sort of, you know, idealistic proposals that in reality is going to go nowhere. There are variants of it that already exist. Alaska, for years and years, has had the permanent dividend fund. They give every man, woman, and child in Alaska a check based on oil windfall profits. Last year it was $1,000, I think. Some years it's been $3,000. It's a pretty significant amount. The Associated Press calculated that if someone had lived in Alaska the entire time of the permanent dividend fund, which is about 33 years, they would have got about $39,000. So it's a not insignificant amount of money. Now, obviously, Alaska is a large state with a small population, and it's very mineral rich. So it's got certain benefits that a lot of states don't have. But there's no reason that we couldn't, for example, tax mineral extraction in every state or tax public land usage in every state, and then recycle that money back into an equivalent of a basic guaranteed income. How politically sellable is it? That comes back to the sort of conversation about what government is and should be. You could probably sell that in Sweden, let's say, or probably could have sold it in Sweden 45, 50 years ago. Could you sell it in a country where any and every attempt to ameliorate social conditions is denounced as socialism? Probably not, at least not for a while. You'd have to have sort of other conversations first. That comes to your second point, these long trains that trigger broader reform. So Social Security triggers a much broader conversation about poverty. Food programs trigger a much bigger conversation about basic government assumptions. Healthcare reform could and should do the same thing. It did in Europe. You know, where I come from, London, National Health Service came out of World War II, came out of the Beveridge Report, which was this blueprint for what a post-war fair society would look like. And the centerpiece of it was national healthcare, but it wasn't the only thing. In its wake came things like milk money, guaranteed money for mothers and children, family leave. My sister just had a baby. She gets about, I think, 4 months fully paid maternity leave every time she has a kid. In Sweden, it's like a year. All of that came out of a conversation about healthcare responsibilities in England. So, you know, could we have a much broader conversation about social obligation? Yes, but only if healthcare works and only if it becomes durable. Now, you know, again, in some ways, what happened in 2012, last month, what happened in the election, there were a lot of things about it that were fascinating. One of the most durable things historically will be the fact that healthcare reform is now going to be a reality, because most of its provisions kick in 2014. And whatever the Republicans say today, I don't for a minute believe that once its provisions kick in and once people are guaranteed healthcare and once kids in particular are guaranteed healthcare, nobody politically is going to be able to roll that back. It will become as institutionalized as Social Security. You're disagreeing, and maybe we should have, well, I think you'd probably follow up with me on that in a minute. My sense is it will become durable. Doesn't mean it won't be tinkered with, but it will be tinkered with. But the basic principle of healthcare as something akin to a right will become sellable and popular. In the same way as once Social Security was implemented and once Medicare was implemented, they became both acceptable and popular. If that happens, And if there are, I think your point about cost control is important. If it happens, and if it happens in a way that allows for healthcare to be provided without bankrupting other parts of the government, if it happens, there are experiments all around the country how to rein in healthcare costs. Oregon is doing some fantastic things on healthcare costs. If there are ways to fuse some of the cost reductions with a principle of universality, it will reinvent government significantly. How significantly, I don't know, but it will leave our understanding of government in a very different place from where it is now, and that to me is important. Yes, sir.
Well, first of all, I wanted to thank you, and then secondly, you know, we hear about the issues of poverty, either on an education standpoint or even here in New York, when Mayor Bloomberg was trying to expand the poverty index. I think you answered one of my questions, which was, would your book go into more elaborate policy prescriptions? But I guess part of my concern is, how are you utilizing the website and the pending book in terms of diversifying the audiences of people who are speaking of the issues of poverty? Because part of my concern of what you mentioned, I actually don't think that the body politic is going to change demonstrably. You know, because of reapportionment and the recent election, the bottom line is, for the next foreseeable 4 to 10 years, we're going to have a very different connotation of how people view public policy discourse. And we don't go into elaborate detail, such as you're doing here. So how do we measure the issues of poverty in tangible ways? You mentioned healthcare, but certain other things. You know, we've seen it talked about through reentry programs and things of that nature. But I'm curious, are there current programs now that you think can galvanize a wide spectrum of policy actors to push more aggressively on really solving the issue of poverty in a number of different ways?
Well, on your first question about policy prescriptions, the answer is yes. I go into, I mean, my book's 450 pages long, which is a long, long book, and I don't expect anyone to read the whole thing, but the first half is very much about the voices of poverty, what poverty is, what it looks like, what it feels like. And the second part is a set of prescriptions. Here's what poverty is, here are the political conditions that allow it to exist, and here are the economic solutions. If we can get the political conditions right, here are the economic changes that I'd recommend that would significantly impact it. Now, some of them are quite technical. They're things like changes in the tax code, changes in the welfare system. But some of them you can communicate to a mass audience with a moral base. And you asked me, you know, how do we engage a broader audience in questions of poverty? I would say the same way Michael Harrington did it in 62, the same way Jacob Rees did it a half century earlier, the same way Henry Mayhew did in Victorian London. If you can both visually describe it and morally describe it in a way that allows an audience to empathize, you can trigger a public conversation. Now, if you had said to an audience in 1959 or 1960 in America, we're going to be having a national conversation about poverty as a moral crisis 4 years from now, most Americans would have said, you're crazy. And 4 years later, we were in the middle of a war on poverty, at least in part because people like Michael Harrington had made it a moral issue. You fast forward another 3 years, you had this tremendous focus on hunger. So you had people like Ed Morrow, the great news anchor Ed Morrow, reporting on the Mississippi Delta. And in his wake, you had Robert Kennedy and various other senators going down to the poorest regions in the country, talking to people, getting a visceral sense of what poverty meant in their lives, then coming back to D.C. with a moral critique and holding hearings with a sort of emergency character to them. There was nothing sedate about Robert Kennedy's hearings. Now, all of that happens in a remarkably brief period of time, from the Eisenhower years to 67, 7 years. But the discourse changes absolutely. Now, it seems to me that we're in the same kind of moment today, that the poverty is there, the crisis is there. There's a huge number of grassroots groups working on this. Groups like, if you want, there's the National People's Action, for example, out of Chicago, working on economic justice. Then there are groups like the Domestic Workers Alliance, Ajahn Poo's group. Now, you know, they're working on organizing under-organized poor parts of the electorate and of the working population. There are groups in the Southwest working with undocumented migrants who live in the Colonias. I don't know if any of you have visited the Colonias, but they're basically these modern-day unincorporated shanty towns. in the deserts of New Mexico and Texas and Arizona and California, and hundreds of thousands to millions of people live in them. And that's a well of human misery that's largely invisible, but there are people out there doing organizing. So the question is, how do you then coordinate all of that? I don't think there's a single answer. I don't think there's one group. I don't think there's one individual. But I do think you can build up momentum, and that at a certain point, it becomes a moral imperative. And I think that can happen quite quickly, in the same way as it happened very, very quickly from 1962, when Harrington published The Other America, to 1964. It's about 19 or 20 months, less than that, actually, because the War on Poverty was actually launched in January 64 in the State of the Union address. So it's about 15 months, and in that 15 months, an entire national discourse was created. I see no reason that could not happen again today.
Good note to end on. Thank you all, and how about a round of applause for Sasha?